wanted to just mention a few things that I left out last night that I was rushing through this information so fast. I left a couple of important things out last night. As you remember, we talked about Charles Potter's theory that Jesus was among the Essenes. It's based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And also the importance of Enoch in these books of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Enoch was mentioned in the Bible in the book of Jude, verse 14 and 15. If you're interested, you can read this. It's a one-page book, so it's easy to read. And he is talking in Jude about fallen angels and such. If you remember from last night, we talked about that. On this theory of, or legend of Nicholas Notovitch's find, I kind of wanted to introduce you to a couple of books that I've used on it. This book's called The Jesus Mystery. It was written by Janet Bach, and they traveled around India in the footsteps of Christ, and they made a movie, her and her husband, Richard Bach, they made a movie about the lost years of Christ, and that movie is based on the Notovitch find and also what the yogis of India said about Christ. They filmed and recorded that, and it's talked about. This book just came out in 1980. Also, I have another book that was printed in 1980 by the Leaves of Healing publication. This is just Nicholas Notovitch's own account and a translation of the scripts. That's all that's really in this book. The book that's the best one available, it's called The Lost Years of Jesus, Elizabeth Clare Prophet. This book came out a couple of months before Christmas. It's the most complete work on this Notovitch find. Tonight, I'd like to get into a whole other area for sources. And we're kind of lost, you know, when we start looking into mysteries like this, as to where can we find a source. And I'd like to talk about what the psychics said about Jesus and where he was during his last years. I know you might be a little bit skeptical right off about psychics, and so I want to take some time to explain a little bit about a psychic named Edgar Cayce. Some of you may have heard of him. Now, what I'm talking about here is not fortune telling and seance stuff. We're talking about something of totally different than that. The works of Edgar Cayce have been witnessed and documented extensively. Edgar Cayce died in 1946, but there's still an association that makes the things that Cayce said available to us. Now, as I talk about Edgar Cayce said this or said that, I want to make it clear that Edgar Cayce didn't say hardly anything. He was a knowledge channel, and he channeled knowledge from other planes of reality or consciousness. He went into sort of a sleep-like state, and through a conductor who would guide him in what he called a reading, he would speak the knowledge from these knowledge sources. Most of the work he did was medical diagnosis. His medical readings, when he died, he had left approximately 20,000 medical readings. They went something like a patient or someone that was ill would write a letter to him, and they would tell him where they would be on a certain day at a certain time and their name. That's all the information that he needed. He would give a complete medical diagnosis of the patient in precise, detailed medical terminology.
He would also prescribe a detailed treatment for the person. He used all schools of medicine. He used schools of medicine from ancient Egypt. He used holistic cures. He used modern surgery, whatever best suited the needs of the patient. Everything that Casey said as he got into doing these readings was written down. It was typed as it came from his mouth by his secretary, Gladys Davis. He was known by some noted doctors of his time, and his medical work was known to be 90% accurate in his diagnosis. There's one book I have here. It's called The Edgar Casey Handbook for Help Through Drugless Therapy. By Dr. Harold J. Riley. Harold J. Riley, for more than 30 years, the Riley Health Institute in Rockefeller Center was a health mecca for prominent people, government leaders such as this late Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, former Attorney General Herbert Brownell, Congressman James Delaney, and ex-Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller. And the list goes on of movie stars and people. He had a health institute in the Rockefeller Center and was a well-established physician of his time. Edgar Casey gave a reading one day, and he specified an unusual treatment of colored light for the patient. And the patient didn't know where he could get that kind of a treatment. And so in another reading, they asked Edgar Casey where he could go, and he just gave the name of this man in New York. That's how Harold Riley met Edgar Casey, became a lifelong friend of his, and worked with him a lot. The medical psychic work of Edgar Casey is the more tangible material. He would give a diagnosis, and the patient would take this diagnosis to his own doctor, and the doctor would examine the patient to see what he would find. He also did non-medical readings. People would ask him questions of the ages or whatever, and he was able to answer. That's not quite as tangible as the medical readings, of course. We really can't. There's no way to double check it. So you have to kind of look at the accuracy of his medical works, I think, to get any idea of how accurate the other material is. Now, when he gave 10,000 non-medical readings approximately in his life, and about 20,000 medical readings. He is such a mass of material that the association finally decided just to catalog all this material by subject, each of the readings. And if you want, you can pick a subject and write to them, and they will send you all of the readings that are on that one particular subject. For example, if you have a heart ailment, you can write that that's your problem. They'll send you all the readings that he did on anyone out of 20,000 medical readings that pertain to heart ailment. I think there's 300 different subjects that it's covered in his material, and some of it's very, in his non-medical files, it's controversial stuff. He talks of Atlanta, different things like that. I was just going to pass this list around. I'll start around. You can look at it if you want. Okay, where did Edgar Casey get this knowledge from? Saints and psychics throughout the history have referred to an Akashic record. Akasha meaning ether of the universe. It also means primal source. The record is believed to contain a continuous record of mankind's earthly experience. perhaps comparable to a cosmic computer, which only a privileged few have been able to tune into. It's said to be the source of revelations, prophecies, and etc. Edgar Cayce felt that the Bible was the largest record of psychic experience ever recorded. It's kind of like a big magic box we can plug into and get our answers from. That's where Edgar Cayce said that he got his information from. Let's read what Edgar Cayce said about the travels of Jesus. In his material, he was more detailed and specific about the preparation and teaching of Jesus' mother before Christ was born. She was supposedly among the Essene masters and studied with them for several years. And according to his works, Joseph was actually chosen by the Essenes to be the wife of Mary, his mother. He doesn't tell too much in detail about Christ's life in his works, and the reason for that is probably he wasn't asked in detail. Whenever he was asked a question, he answered it, but he covered so much material, I guess that was one they just weren't interested in at that time. This is what Edgar Cayce said in one of his readings. Upon the skein of time and space are the records made, for thoughts and deeds are indeed things, and their currents run with time and space and make their impressions there. Just as in the mental forces, it is gradually being comprehended that as the man, as the being thinketh in his heart, so is he. He's referring to the Akashic records there. Perhaps this is God's big book. This is the source of his knowledge. One of his trance states, he says, the period of study was only at the time of his sojourn in the temple or in Jerusalem, during those periods when he was quoted by Luke as being among the rabbis or teachers. His studies in India, Persia, and Egypt covered much greater periods, that there might be completed the more perfect knowledge of the material related to those cleansings of the body in preparation for strength of the physical as well as in the mental man. That's basically what Cayce said. He just said he was in India, Persia. Something else here that's interesting that Edgar Cayce talked about. He came, this soul we know as Jesus, in many different ages as a spokesman to manifest the first idea. These incarnations were given as Adam, Enoch, Melchizedek, Joseph, Joshua, Jeshua, and finally Jesus. And Cayce further said, this soul who came as Jesus has come in all ages, when it has been necessary for the understanding to be centered in new application of the same thought. God is spirit, and seek such to worship him in spirit and in truth. I wanted to mention another psychic that I've studied some of his works. He's alive today, lives in Garden City, Michigan. He does the same type of psychic work as Edgar Cayce did. His name's Ross Peterson. Ross Peterson's done a lot of work with the director of the Mount Sinai Clinic in New York and some prominent doctors of Canada, and they say that he is 80% accurate in his medical readings, and he, in his readings, has given reasons why he's not as accurate as Edgar Cayce was in his reading. Some others you may have heard of, Ruth Montgomery, she's an automatic writer. Seth's an entity. who speaks through Jane Roberts. That's a little different. With Edgar Cayce, there wasn't a personality that spoke through him. Jane Roberts, there's a personality that speaks through her named Seth. Those kind of psychics are more commonly known as trance channelers, and their works are quite impressive also. I feel that, you know, before you get skeptical about this kind of thing, I'd just like to ask you to look into Edgar Cayce's works with an open mind and decide for yourself what you think. I want to talk about a psychic now named Levi. His name is Levi H. Dowling. He wrote a book. It's called The Aquarian Gospel of Jesus Christ. This book is copyright 1907. It's on its 52nd printing. This is a 1982 copy. This book is said to be transcribed from the Akashic Records. I don't really know too much about Levi. I really get the impression from the introduction that even the people who were around him and published this book didn't really understand or know what he was doing. They feel that this book stands for itself. This is something that's to be read, and you decide for yourself whether you want to buy what Levi has written here. It's a very impressive work. It's an entire gospel of Christ's life, like the gospels in the New Testament. It's extremely detailed, and it's also written in chapter and verse, just like the Bible. For someone to invent something like this book and write it out of their imagination, I don't think if we found that out we should be angry at them. I think they should get some kind of a literary award. This book is very impressive in the way it's written. Levi died in 1911. There's a few things written about him in the front of this book I'd like to read. There is a little bit written to tell us who he was. In 1866 and 7, he was a student at Northwestern Christian University at Indianapolis, Indiana. The next year, he began publishing Sunday school literature, issuing Sunday school lesson papers, songbooks, and children's Sunday school paper. Much of his time was devoted to the cause of prohibition. He was a graduate of two medical colleges and practiced medicine for a number of years. He finally retired from the medical profession to resume literary work. This was a paper that was found among the things that Levi left. No one really knows what it meant or anything. It's called The Cusp of the Ages. In spirit, I was caught away into the realms of Akasha. I stood alone within the circle of the sun, and there I found the secret spring that opens up the door to wisdom and understanding heart. I entered in, and then I knew. I saw the 24 cherubim and seraphim that guard the circle of the sun, the mighty ones who were proclaimed by the masters long ago, the 24 ancient ones. This goes on, and he talks about seeing some sort of a ceremony where the seraphim and cherubim of this age take seat over the guardians of the past age. In other words, there are two guardians, apparently, of the age of Aquarius, and the old guardians stand down, and the new ones come forward. There's 24 because there's 12 cycles of the zodiac, two for each age. This is another paper that they found, and it's about Levi's commission. It says, "And then Vissel, the Holy One, stood forth and said, O Levi, son of man, behold, for you are called to be a message bearer of the coming age, the age of spirit blessedness. Give heed, O Son of Man, for men must know the Christ, the love of God, for love is sovereign balm for all the wounds of men, the remedy for every ill. And man must be endowed with wisdom and with power, with an understanding heart. Behold the Akasha, behold the record galleries of Vissel, where every thought and word and deed of every living thing is written down. The needs of men are manifold, and men must know their needs. Now, Levi, hearken to my words. Go forth into these mystic galleries and read. There you will find a message for the world, for every man, for every living thing. I breathe upon you now the holy breath. You will discriminate, and you will know the lessons that these record books of God are keeping now for men of this new age. It goes on for a while and talks about how everything that's written down he's not permitted to record. It says, now, Levi, message bearer of the spirit age, take up your pen and write. Write full the story of Christ, who built upon the solid rock of yonder circle of the sun, the Christ whom men have known as Enoch, the initiate. Write of his works as prophet, priest, and seer. Write of his life of purity and love, and how he changed his carnal flesh to flesh divine without descending to the gates of death. And you may write the story of Melchizedek, the Christ who lived when Abram lived, and pointed out to men the way of life through sacrifice, who gave his life a willing sacrifice for men. And you may write the story of the Prince of Peace, the Christ who came as the babe in Bethlehem, and traveled every way of life that man must tread. That's parts of it that will relate to more what we're talking about. I wanted just to read from this book for a while. The most notable thing about this book, I think, is the story of where Jesus traveled during the last years parallels Notovitch's story very closely and in exactly in some respects. It's more specific and detailed. It starts out in the beginning talking about the education of Mary, the education of Jesus, John the Harbinger, or I suppose that's the right pronunciation, John the Baptist. It says that Joseph, Jesus' father, was an Essene. That kind of relates back to Potter's theory in a way, but it doesn't talk in detail about that. Okay, before I wanted to start a little bit before the age of 12. There's something kind of interesting in here. It's about Jesus' study in Jerusalem with Hillel, who was a master of that time. It says, but Jesus went to the Passover and he was alarmed at all the sacrifices of animals and things like that, and he goes to Hillel because he's upset by the killing that goes on. He says, Rabboni, I would like to talk with you. I'm disturbed about this service of the Paschal feast. I thought the temple was the house of God where the loved ones in kindness dwell. Do you not hear the bleating of those lambs, the pleating of those doves that men are killing over there? Do you not smell that awful stench that comes from the burning flesh? Can man be kind and just and still be filled with cruelty? He talks with Hillel, and Hillel is impressed at the wisdom of this child. So Hillel sought out the parents of Jesus and asked if he could come and study with him in the temple for a year. I looked up in the Oxford Christian Dictionary in the library, and it says in there, Hillel, school of. The followers of Hillel, an influential rabbinical teacher of the time of Christ, in opposition to the school of Shammai, the Hillites upheld a liberal and lenient interpretation of the law, and their attitude in controversy, whether religious or political, towards Jew and Gentile alike, was tolerant and conciliatory. The influence of the Hillites was at its greatest after the destruction of the temple, AD 70. The Talmud records the many differences of opinion between the two schools. Okay, now we can talk about Jesus leaving Nazareth and this, the account you hear of that. This story of how Jesus left is a little bit different than Notovitch's account. He says the royal prince of India, Ravana of Orissa in the south, Orissa is in India. I'm sorry I just said that. He was at the Jewish feast. Ravana was a man of wealth, and he was just, and had a band of Brahmic priests who he sought wisdom with in the west. He saw Jesus speak and was very impressed. He asked Hillel who he was and went to the home of Jesus. For certain days, Ravana was a guest in Joseph's home on Marmion Way. This book said that Jesus lived on Marmion Way. It tells us exactly where his house was, in fact. He sought to learn the secret wisdom of the Son, but it was all too great for him. And then he asked that he might be the patron of the child, might take him to the east where he could learn the wisdom of the Brahms. And Jesus longed to go that he might learn, and after many days his parents gave consent. Then with proud heart, Ravana, with his train, began the journey toward the rising sun. And after many days they crossed the Sindh and reached the province of Orissa and in the palace of the prince. The Brahmic priests were glad to welcome home the prince. With favor they received the Jewish boy. And Jesus accepted as a pupil in the was accepted in the temple of Jagannath, and here learned the Vedas and the Manic laws. Now the temple of Jagannath is where Notovitch also said that Jesus went to in India. It's a direct parallel there. In the book, they talk more specifically about Jesus' learning and teaching also in Jagannath. One of his masters was named Lameus. It says, among the priests of Jagannath was one who loved a Jewish boy. Lameus Ramus was the name by which the priest was known. We've got 9 chapters here that talk about Jesus' experience at the temple of Jagannath and in and about this area, which includes Benares, these are holy cities of the Ganges River Valley in India. Notovitch covered it in about the equivalent of 1 chapter of this book, and this book covers it in 9 chapters. Here are a few things that are said about it. Now Jesus with his friend Lameus went through all the regions of Orissa and the valley of the Ganges, seeking wisdom from the Sudras and the Visyas and the masters. Benares of Ganges was a city rich in culture and in learning. Here the two Rabbonis tarried many days, and Jesus sought to learn the Hindu art of healing and became the pupil of Yudraka, greatest of Hindu healers. The city of Benares is famous also because it was near Benares in the Deer Park that Buddha first gave his talk after he learned the way to attain enlightenment. He talked to his disciples there, and it's a very holy city that goes way back in history. It says 4 years the Jewish boy abode in the temple Jagannath. Notovitch said that Jesus was in the temple Jagannath for 6 years. I don't think it's really a contradiction because Jesus spent 6 years in this region, but he was only in the temple for 4 years. It gives the same story as Notovitch here about Jesus having problems in India because of He didn't go along with the case system. And he started teaching and going among the lower class people, and it upset the masters of the Brahmin faith. Finally, the priests of the temple of Jagannath became very angry with him, and they threw him out of the temple. This is where Jesus sort of attacks the god Brahma. It says, and Jesus said, the Parabrahm is not a god of justice and of right. With his own strong hand, he has exalted one and brought another low. And Jesus talked on about God for a while. And it says, all the priests were angered by the words which Jesus spoke. They rushed upon him, seized him, and would have done him harm. Lameus, this friend of Jesus that he first met when he came to Jagannath, it says, Lameus pled for Jesus' life, and then the priests just seized a scourge of cords and drove him from the place. And Jesus went his way and found a shelter with the black and yellow men, the servants and the tillers of the soil. Those were called the Sudras and the Vishyas. Those are lower caste people of India. In the beginning of each chapter here, he sort of outlined the chapter. The material is so vast, I was just going to read kind of a few chapter introductions of his experience after he left the temple Jagannath, but he's still in this region of India. It says, Jesus teaches the Sudras and farmers, relates a parable of a nobleman and his unjust sons, makes known the possibilities of all men. The next chapter is Jesus at Katak, the car of Jagannath. Jesus reveals to the people the emptiness of the Brahmic rites and how to see God in man, teaches them the divine law of sacrifice. Next chapter, Jesus attends a feast in Bihar, preaches a revolutionary sermon on human equality, relates the parable of the broken blades. Chapter 28, Yadraka gives a feast in Jesus' honor. Jesus speaks on the unity of God and the brotherhood of life, criticizes the priesthood, becomes the guest of a farmer. Goes on quite a bit of detail. Also, here's one that's kind of interesting. Jesus receives news of the death of his father. He writes a letter to his mother. The letter he sends on its way by a merchant. Says that Jesus tarried many days in Benares and taught. Finally, the Brahmic priests became enraged with Jesus. That's what the same as the Notovich account says. And they plotted to kill him. Let me read this part. He shook the very sand on which the Brahmic system stood. He made the Brahmic idol seem so small and sacrifice so fraught with sin that shrines and wheels of prayer were all forgot. The priest declared that if the Hebrew boy should tarry longer in the land, a revolution would occur. The common people would arise and kill the priests and tear the temples down. And so they sent a call abroad, and priests from every province came. Benares was on fire with Brahmic zeal. Lameus defended him and in his last run-in with the Brahmic priests, and this time he caught wind that they'd plotted to kill him, and he warned Jesus. So Jesus left. By night he left Benares with the hasty journey to the north, and everywhere the farmers, merchants, and the Sudras helped him on his way. And after many days he reached the mighty Himalayas. In the city of Kapivatstu he abode. The priests of Buddha opened wide their temple doors for him. This is exactly the same account that Notovich gave. This city, Kapivastu, is the birthplace of the Buddha, or said to be. The great Asoka pillar is there, placed by King Asoka a couple hundred years after the death of Buddhas, but before the death of Christ. I was there at this time last year, but right at the moment I can't think of the modern name of the city. It's right on the border of Nepal and India. And there's really nothing going on there today very much. It's kind of just a farming area. So a couple of Buddhist monasteries there. It says, among the Buddhist priests was one who saw a lofty wisdom in the words that Jesus spoke. It was Bharata Arabo. Together, Jesus and Bharata read the Jewish Psalms and prophets, read the Vedas, the Avesta, and the wisdom of Gautama. Gautama was Buddha. So it gives more detail once again than Notovitch. It tells who he studied with, the names of his masters, a lot of stories about him teaching as well as being taught. Jesus spent some time there, and then in the next section it talks about Jesus going to Tibet. It's the same sequence as the Notovitch story once again. In Lhasa of Tibet, there was a master's temple, rich in manuscripts of ancient lore. The Indian sage had read these manuscripts, and he revealed to Jesus many of the secret lessons they contained, but Jesus wished to read them for himself. Now Mengste, greatest sage of all the further east, was in this temple of Tibet. Mengste was the Dalai Lama, I believe, of those days. We call him the Dalai Lama, and in here they refer to him as Mengste. So some of these masters I couldn't verify because, well, I got Hillel out of the Christian dictionary, but we don't have a dictionary of Indians and Buddhists in that. So that's something I could verify a little better further on. The path across Emotis Heights was difficult, but Jesus started on his way, and Vajrapati sent him with a trusted guide. And Vajrapati sent a message to Mengste, in which he told about the Hebrew sage and spoke for him a welcome by the temple priests. Now after many days and perils great, the guide and Jesus reached Lhasa, temple in Tibet. And Mengste opened wide the temple doors, and all the priests and masters gave a welcome to the Hebrew sage. And Jesus had access to all the sacred manuscripts, and with the help of Mengste, read them all. And Mengste often talked with Jesus of the coming age, and of the sacred service best adapted for the people of the age. And in Lhasa, Jesus did not teach. When he had finished all his studies in the temple schools, he journeyed toward the west. In many villages he tarried for a time and taught. At last he reached the pass, and in the Ladakh city, Leh, he was received with favor by the monks, the merchants, and the men of low estate. Okay, when he got to Ladakh, Leh, this is where Nicholas Notovitch found the scrolls of the from this story we talked about last night in the city of Ladakh, in the city Leh of Ladakh. Ladakh is the little Tibet. It's western Tibet. And in the monastery he abode and taught, and then he sought the common people in the marts of trade, and there he taught. Okay, it goes on with a lot of detail about his time he spent in Tibet, and then it gets into his life and works of Jesus in Persia. Notovitch also mentions, the scrolls of Notovitch mention Jesus being in Persia after going to Tibet. It says, 24 years of age was Jesus when he entered Persia on his homeward way. In many a hamlet, town, and neighborhood he paused a while and taught and healed. The priests and ruling classes did not welcome him because he censured them for cruelty to those of low estate. The common people followed him in throngs. At times the chiefs made bold to try to hinder him, forbidding him to teach or heal the sick, but he regarded not their angry threats. He taught and healed the sick. In time, he reached Persepolis, the city where the kings of Persia were entombed, the city of the learned Magi, Or and Lun and Mer, the three wise men, who 24 years before had seen the Star of Promise rise above Jerusalem, and who had journeyed to the west to find the newborn king. And where the and they were the first to honor Jesus as the master of the age, and gave him gifts of gold, gumthus, and myrrh. These magi knew by ways that masters always know when Jesus neared Persepolis. And then they girt themselves and went to meet him on the way. And when they met, a light much brighter than the light of day surrounded them. And men who saw the four stand in the way declared that they were transfigured, seeming more like gods than men. Now Or and Lun were aged men, and Jesus placed them on his beast to ride into Persepolis, whilst he and Mer led on the way. And when they reached the Magi's home, they all rejoiced, and Jesus told the thrilling story of his life. And Or and Lun and Mer spoke not. They only looked to the heaven, and in their hearts praised God. Three wise men from the north were in Persepolis, and they were Caspar, Zara, and Melzon. And Caspar was the wisest master of the Magian land. These three were at the home of Or and Lun and Mer when Jesus came. For 7 days these seven men spoke not. They sat in silence in the council hall in close communion with the silent brotherhood. They sought for light, for revelation, and for power. The laws and precepts of the coming age required all the wisdom of the masters of the world. It's kind of an interesting account of the Jesus' relationship with the three wise men. There's a little bit more about the silent brotherhood. Now in the early morning, Jesus came again to teach and heal. A light not comprehended shone about, as though some mighty spirit overshadowed him. A Magus noted this and asked him privately to tell from whence his wisdom came, and what the meaning of the light. And Jesus said, "There is a silence where the soul may meet its God, and there the font of wisdom is, and all who enter in are immersed in the light, and filled with wisdom, love, and power." Jesus spent some time among these wise men in Persia, and finally went on his way. Now, according to Notovitch's find, after the last in those scrolls, they talk of Jesus' travel was in Persia, and then it just says he traveled and taught in many places in his journey going back to Nazareth. This is where Levi's account varies. Just perhaps with more detail, talks about the lives and works of Jesus in Assyria. In Persia, Jesus' work was done, and he resumed his journey towards his native land. The Persian sage went with him to the Euphrates, then with the pledge that they would all meet again in Egypt land, the master said farewell. I didn't introduce this other Persian sage that Jesus was studying with in Persia, but they traveled together to the Euphrates, and then they divided, and they agreed to meet again in Nazareth. In Assyria, Jesus visited the ruins of Babylon. Said the ruined Babylon was near, and Jesus and the sage went through their gates and walked among her fallen palaces. Apparently Babylon is in the plains of Shinar. It says, "Now in the plains of Shinar Jesus tarried yet for 7 days, and with Ashbina meditated long. upon the needs of men and how the sages could best serve the coming age. Then Jesus went his way, and after many days he crossed the Jordan to his native land. At once he sought his home in Nazareth.
Just three things that we'll do. We'll spend some time together talking about his Matthew Fox's reasons for a new paradigm, and then I'd like to break up into three small groups to talk about some aspects of the first path, and then get back together again and share some of our learnings in that process of sharing. I'm not going to be laying out much from that. I'm assuming you either have read it or are going to get into it as you talk about it. And it's going to be your responsibility to do some of the reading. I'll be glad to respond from anywhere along the line. But first I wanted to see if you would examine the ones that are up here, the 10 reasons for a new paradigm. And first of all, would you be willing to look at them a while and rank them? How do those come out for you? What's more important and what's less important, or what's more meaningful indeed to you and what's less? You just look at them. I don't know if you can read it all. I hope you can.
Is number 6 hope versus pessimism?
Pessimism, cynicism, and sadism. Sadism, sadism.
Number 1, oh, crisis.
The crises, yeah. And the two that he lifts up are the ecological crisis, which includes nuclear, as he talks about it, and then unemployment.
I think global ecumenism is a pretty big one.
Okay.
It's like if all the religions of the world would get together and be a unified...
Are you saying then that these are needs that require a new paradigm, or these are things that are happening that make a new paradigm possible? How do you see his reasons, his thing? The way you said that made it sound like, since that's such an important need, that ought to be the root of it.
Okay, when he came to Nazareth, according to this, he didn't stay in Nazareth this time. He returned to Nazareth, and then he traveled further and came back to fulfill his ministry. He visited his family and his mother in Nazareth. His brothers were very skeptical of him, called him an indolent and an ambitious, vain, worthless fortune hunter, searcher of the world for fame, it says. And he didn't meet the approval of his brothers. It says here, and Jesus called aside his mother and her sister, Miriam, and told them of his journey to the east. He told them of the lessons he had learned and of the works that he had done. To others he told not the story of his life. Okay, apparently, according to this, after Jesus visited his family in Jerusalem, he traveled to Greece. And the next section gets into his life and works in Greece. So I'll just read the headings of a few chapters to give you an idea of his experience in Greece. Jesus visits Greece and is welcomed by the Athenians. He meets Apollo, addresses the Grecian masters in the amphitheater, and the address is given in this chapter. Jesus teaches the Greek masters, goes with Apollo to Delphi, and hears the oracle speak. It testifies for him. He abides with Apollo and is recognized as the living oracle of God. Explains to Apollo the phenomena of oracular speech. I don't know, I haven't studied too much about the oracles of Greece, but they, in their myths and that, they felt that they had oracles that spoke to them, and Jesus explains this phenomenon to them, and according to this book, it was a real thing that did happen. Later on, you'll find that after Jesus, in the end of this book, it talks about his resurrection, and he ascended down in Greece on the oracle, and it spoke no more, and it was the end of the oracles in Greece for the ages. Also, after Jesus was in Greece, he went to Egypt and he studied among the great masters of Egypt and learned the secret knowledge of the Egyptians. Jesus with Elihu and Salome in Egypt tells the story of his journeys. Elihu and Salome praise God. Jesus goes to the temple in Heliopolis and is received as a pupil. Jesus receives from the Hierophant his mystic name and number, passes the first brotherhood test, and receives his first degree, sincerity. And the way he studied among the Egyptian masters, they sort of tested him, and then they placed upon him degrees of learning, and he passed through all their schools. And there's many, many stories and writings and things about the secret knowledge of the Egyptians. And we know just from archaeology that the Egyptians were quite an intelligent people. And perhaps if there are hidden mysteries to the universe, the Egyptians were aware of some of these keys. Jesus studied all of this with them, and he mastered their schools with relative ease, and they were very impressed with Jesus. The last school that they put him through was work that he did in the chamber of the dead. It says, the work of Jesus in the chamber of the dead was done, and in the temple purple room he stood before the Hierophant. And he was clothed in purple robes, and all the brothers stood. The Hierophant arose and said, this is a royal day for all the hosts of Israel. In honor of their chosen son, we celebrate the great Passover feast. And then the Hierophant said to Jesus, brother man, most excellent of men, in all the temple tests you have won out. Six times before the bar of right you have been judged. Six times you have received the highest honors man can give. And now you stand prepared to take the last degree. Upon your brow I place this diadem, and in the great lodge of the heavens and earth, you are the Christ. This is your great Passover rite. You are a neophyte no more, but now a mastermind. Now man can do no more, but God himself will speak and will confirm your title and degree. Go on your way, for you must preach the gospel of goodwill to men and peace on earth, must open up the prison doors and set the captives free. And while the Hierophant yet spoke, the temple bells rang out, and a pure white dove descended upon and sat on Jesus' head. And then a voice that shook the very temple said, this is the Christ. And every living creature said, amen. The great doors of the temple swung ajar, and the Logos journeyed on his way, a conqueror. The next section, they talk about the meeting of the Council of the Seven Sages of the World. Mengste was one, Hillel, one of Jesus' masters, was another. Jesus studied among the seven sages of the world, and this is a story about his studies with them. And it says in here that at the beginning of every new age, the seven sages of the world meet in council. It gives the meaning of that and also goes into detail of what was covered in this council. I won't go into it. Next section, he talks about the ministry of John the Baptist. And apparently, according to this, John the Baptist knew at an early age that he was Elijah returned and that he was here to prepare the way for the Christ. And then it talks about here John the Baptist when he baptizes Jesus. And as they came out of the stream, the holy breath in form of dove came down and sat on Jesus' head. Then we go into the Christine ministry of Jesus, the first epoch
in the first, second, and third year of his ministry. This book also talks of many of the things that you would read in the New Testament, a lot of the same parables, but a lot more detail is covered. It's a lot more specific. A lot more of the teachings of Christ are written about in here. Also talks in a lot of detail about his crucifixion and the actual events that took place around that. That's not the subject of our discussion, but that is one way that you can decide for yourself when studying a book like this. You know, you have something to compare what's written in here with. If you know the Bible and you've read the books of the Bible. I'll just read the titles from the last sections of the book from that point on. After the third annual epoch of the Christian ministry of Jesus, there's a section on the betrayal and arrest of Jesus, the trial and execution of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, the materialization of the body of Jesus Christ, and then there's a chapter in the end on the establishment of the early Christian church. This book I came into just a couple of months ago, and actually I've studied the psychic's works, particularly Edgar Cayce, in depth for about 5 years. This is a very interesting book for me, and I intend to look further into what other noted psychics are going to say about it. I'm just going to stop now. Looks like I almost used up a whole hour, but I got it all in this time. And there's something else I wanted to do when I finished with this book. This book is about Nicholas Notovitch, and I wanted to pass it around. I have a bookmark in here. There's a little map of the Notovitch account of the travels of Jesus. And I meant to do this earlier and so I could get around while I was talking. I'd like to know what your questions are, and also I'd really appreciate it if maybe not here now, but some other time later on in a day or two, if you've heard of any sources. I don't care how far out they are, my mind is wide open, and that's where it's got to be if I'm going to learn. And if you've heard anything or know of any books or anything written, I don't care if it contradicts or supports or what, I'd like to know, because I intend to keep working on this. And I was just told that today a source that I've been just praying for came into the bookstore, and I'm going to dig into that, perhaps not while I'm up here at Holden. I'll probably put this aside for the time being. But I intend to pursue this further. I think, you know, that there's more work that can be done in any one of these areas that I've talked about tonight, and there's more material. I'm also of the school of thought that, yes, we are in the Aquarian Age, and this is a time when the truth will be known to us. And perhaps truths about the life of Christ or other things are already among us. We just haven't looked for them and found them. And so basically, this is kind of a hobby for me. It gives me something to do, entertain myself, I guess. And I want to continue on. But I'd really appreciate it if you'd share questions or comments with me. I'd like to know what your questions are. So we'll just take time right now, and I'd like to hear something from you. Go ahead, Judy.
One thing that makes me
entrances me about what you're saying and makes me sort of perk up my ears about it is a sense that it makes sense to me that Jesus studied. And I think that the notion that somehow his study stopped at 12 or there's this void for me in his history it has always been confusing for me. And to hear you and then to hear Eckhart talk about study and practice and learning in order to achieve enlightenment or holiness, there's something about that fits for me. So it's I appreciate you digging, I guess, to speculate on that possibility that holiness doesn't just get zapped into you, but it also comes from your own dedication and your own discipline.
Right. Yeah, it does. The material I've covered does suggest this was the case with Christ, which we haven't really known before. Warren.
You know, this Nicholas Notovich, is he the only one that ever transcribed the manuscript or psalm?
Swami Abhidhananda in 1922 went to Jaima's monastery and translated the scrolls. He wrote a book, but he published it in the Bengali language in India. And we haven't had any knowledge of this book or any translations of his Bengali language edition until this book that I passed around came out 2 months ago. After that, Nicholas Rorich, who was an esteemed artist and the head of art departments at two large universities in the United States. He was quite an explorer and anthropologist, traveled all around Asia and wrote his accounts, and he also translated the scrolls. Following that, there was an expedition, I didn't mention this last night, that's a woman named Kasperi, and they traveled up into the Himalayas. They had never heard of Notovich's claims, whereas Rorich and Abhidhananda had. And they were, a monk just showed to them and said, these books say that your Jesus was here. And there's a picture in this book of that monk with his scrolls. And they were excited and amazed, but never translated the books. And they never told the account of their story until Elizabeth Clare Prophet found out about this woman and her trip. This was done in the 50s. And those are the basic people that verify it. There's some modern anthropologists who have been in that region of the world in 1977. There's two or three they talk about in there. And the one writes that although the local people don't seem to know at this time the legend of the scrolls, they can recite the legend of Issa almost verbatim as Notovich translated it. And they really have a high respect and love and esteem for Jesus.
One more question, Ken. Has anybody authenticated how old those scrolls were?
No, that's the question, is what is the source of those scrolls? Mm-hmm. There's different theories in that. You know, the originals have never been seen, actually. The originals were written in the Pali language and were in Tibet in the city of the Dalai Lama. And Tibetan translations of those originals were sent out to the monasteries. And they talk about how when higher level monks visited the other monasteries, it was always traditional for them to bring copies of scrolls that they had as gifts to other monasteries. And they all had huge libraries. So from the original scrolls in Pali spread out the Tibetan translations of the original scrolls. Now Notovich translated a Tibetan translation of a Pali original. No one's ever seen that Pali original. And perhaps it's still contained in the monastery there. When the Dalai Lama came out of India, many scrolls were brought out. And Janet Bach, in this book, she went to where the Dalai Lama lives in India, and she said the library there is vast, but the scrolls are in a total disarray. You know, and there are many different religious scrolls in there, writings of all kinds, and they're not cataloged, and no one really knows what they are, and it's kind of in a... There's so much material, apparently, that no one's really organized it, and, you know, I suppose they're working on it right now. I don't know. This book's 5 years old, so I don't know how that's changed since then.
I keep thinking of Joseph Smith and some of those that found these...
Yeah, it's a similar story. He supposedly interpreted gold plates that were found in the Hill Cumorah, and it was a record of the history of this new world, as the Bible is the history of the old world. It's a related experience in a way. Joseph Smith is more related to the psychic experience, because he translated these scrolls in Egyptian text. And another thing about Joseph Smith is he claimed to be a prophet of God, whereas Edgar Cayce shunned the word prophet. He never claimed to be a prophet. He just called it a gift that he had. He never said that it had anything to do with his religion. He discouraged a following. Apparently, with Levi, there was never any churches or isms founded around him. I really don't know, though, because this book's in its 53rd printing. And so perhaps there is a group of people, you know, that I'm unaware of who have formed around this gospel of Christ. I really don't know. Notovitch is more of a scholastic account, you know. When we get into these others, it's... we're talking about things we don't necessarily understand so clearly and tend to be skeptical of, particularly Joseph Smith. Is quite a fantastic story that he tells. That's another book that, you know, is looked at as you should read it, and the work speaks for itself, whether you believe the way it came about or not. And basically that's what this book is all about. The Book of Mormon is also a very amazing work. For someone to sit down and invent all that and write it up, you know, I wish I could do that.
But if he traveled all that distance during the 18 years, he spent a lot of time on the road.
Yeah,
that's a lot of miles.
18 years is a lot of time, though, really, you know, if you think about it. One question came up to me was that could they travel in those times? Was it available to them? And I wondered about that, but not really for too long. I looked in the Atlas of the Bible that they're using in the winter program. If you look at the travels of Paul, he really got around. Yeah, he made some
Bible
journeys.
He never walked almost a little ways away from. In the Bible, he never traveled very far.
Oh, I don't.
He had all his time.
I don't know. I'm not a Bible student. I don't know where they get that from. But there's a map in there, and it has, you know, the journeys of Paul. Where would that come from?
No, I mean, Jesus never traveled.
Oh, Jesus
never traveled.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the reason that we don't know what Jesus did and where he went and that he studied among these great masters that were non-Jewish, we could get into the controversy theories. You know, the early Christian fathers were given total authority to decide which books were Christian and which books were heretical. And this is fact. They did destroy books that they felt were not acceptable to what they felt was Christianity. That's why the Book of Enoch was lost. It was completely stomped out. It's obvious
that the Book of Enoch was known by Christ because it was a very popular book among the Essenes. They know it was popular because they found many, many copies of the books of Enoch and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some books of Enoch survived and were found in Upper Africa. Let's see, where were they? That was in about the 40s they were found. And these were the first books of Enoch that we knew of. Those were written in a dead language, and the Orientalists couldn't translate those books. Now, they may have done that. This is out of Potter's book. And then I got to remind you, Potter's book was first printed in 1958, you know. I don't have any real good up-to-date theories or information on this Dead Sea Scroll material. I think, you know, I don't want, that's why I wrote the date up there. I'm not trying to, you know, fool you or anything. This isn't really a solid source here. Is there anybody else?
Brad, I might just mention what I told you, that I was in a study group about 5 or 6 years ago with people from my church. Well, they came from all over. This was in Columbia, and they came from D.C., and there was a young man there who was going to the embassy at Taiwan, and there were people from Baltimore, and they met and studied a book that had been written in the 30s, and that told of the travels of Jesus. I don't remember, at that time I was interested in other things, and I don't remember that much. I gotta look into it now, but I remember that he was in Alexandria and in Egypt, according to this. It didn't seem improbable or impossible to me, and it seemed rather possible. And there's these people meet, they don't push the book or anything, but they meet all over the country. And they get together for a national meeting. The foundation is in Chicago.
And they have a book that tells about Jesus' travels.
Hmm. Do you remember the name of the book?
That's the Urantia book.
That's fine. But I have to look into that again.
That's a book I received today.
Oh, you did? I wondered if that was the one.
Yeah.
What's the name of the one you received?
It's Urantia. It's one Jack told me about. Source.
Fred?
Yes.
Yeah, I think a question I have, and maybe sometime you would find out more about this, but my understanding is that there's Jewish scholars today that study the Gospels and the life of Jesus, so they wouldn't have a Christian, so you could trust they wouldn't have a Christian prejudice.
Yeah.
It seemed to indicate that Jesus' teachings are very, very Jewish.
Uh-huh.
You know, they come so deeply from the Jewish tradition, and so the question I have, if Jesus was in contact with Buddhism and other thought,
mm-hmm.
you know, why doesn't that show in Jesus' teaching? I mean, I suppose you could say, well, those who wrote the Gospels weeded them out. Maybe that would be...
Well, I have another thought on that right off the top of my head. In one of these books, they talk about the theory that perhaps Jesus was among the Essenes as well as something along the lines of knowing that she's fun. And he did study with Hillel. So he was aware of the early Jewish teachings. And perhaps, this is just a thought, perhaps since he was among the Jewish people, he used the languages and teachings that they would understand and relate to, and that they were aware of, and he spoke to them in ways that they would understand, and he didn't bother him with a lot of Buddhism and other things, because he studied with all the great masters, but from this book, he didn't stay with any one people, because he knew that he had the one light, and that they were wrong. So what's the point of bothering the people in Jerusalem with Buddhist teachings anyway? You know, he came to, you know, give them the light in a language that they could understand. That's just an idea. I don't know.
The Buddhists in Upper Tibet really feel a kinship with Christianity, and they say that there's many similarities in Buddhism and Christianity, and they feel that Christianity is laced with teachings of Buddhism, you know, but that's another can of worms. Is there anybody else? One thing I'd like to say, you know, suppose Jesus did travel all around India and study with the Buddhists, and that I like the idea that it fits in with our theme of one Lord, many members. It's kind of nice, you know, to look at it that way. And this study to me is very important. If Jesus did indeed influence the people in these parts of the world, it bridges a gap between East and West, and it's very important. And it's something that I think needs to be done, and it's never been done before, to help Christians open up our hearts to other faiths of the world that carry a lot of truths also, and who, you know, worship the true God, if you will.
Along that line, Brad, too, I would point out the fact that people in other parts of the world then had, back in those days, had realized, at least from your descriptions of the writings, that he was the Christ, in fact.
Yeah. They realized, apparently from this, that the word he taught was more correct than whatever they were studying themselves at the time or following.
And it's a possibility, too, that he may have been laying groundwork for his disciples, Paul and Peter, and those, or not Peter particularly, but so those who went out beyond the Jewish nation to teach.
So
they'd be more readily accepted.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought. Follow you on that. Judy.
One thing that makes me nervous in almost everything that you've presented, it's particularly the psychics, I guess, but even when I think of the masters, the seven masters of the universe or whatever.
Yeah.
It sounds as if they're all male. And it makes me wonder, either the truth of the universe is that it is male,
yeah,
and that women enable that, or that there's some gap somewhere, or it's not all true, or there's some screen that everybody hears.
Yeah.
It's like the mediums, or, you know, it just,
yeah,
something makes me feel like there's, either it's missing, or, oh my gosh, this is the truth.
Oh, the boy.
What does this mean?
I never thought about that. But I didn't think about that before, but I just know that historically, and in the older, what should we call them, more primitive societies, this male chauvinistic role thing, or whatever you're talking about, has just been the rule rather than the exception in the history of man, hasn't it? And what we're talking about here were men who lived, not, these sages weren't angels or anything that he refers to here. They were the three wise men. And I don't know, probably in Jerusalem they followed, well, we talked about it the other day, a hierarchy where men were in control, and right or wrong, I imagine, you know, it wouldn't contradict most ancient societies and primitive societies that we know, where men ruled, and it was a men's world. And that's the only thought I have on that. To me, it doesn't necessarily say that God is a man or anything like that, but you'd have to see for yourself. One interesting thing on that, I mentioned someone just before this started, and I guess I can bring it up here since we've talked about psychics. I don't know how many of you have heard of Shirley MacLaine's book. If you're interested in psychic phenomena and you want a really good introduction, that is an excellent book. Okay, and in there she talks about going to Sweden to see a psychic. And it's a trance channeler. It's a personality that speaks through this psychic named Ombres. Okay, I got a letter from Judy, who some of you know is my girlfriend that lives in California. She saw Ombres in San Diego last week. He was there. She went and saw him talk. And he speaks in Swedish, and it's translated. And she said that it was really wonderful for her, as you know, well, it was an experience she couldn't describe with words, I'm sure. But she said one of the things that she really enjoyed and was wonderful about it was that Ombres, this entity, whenever he talked of the collective whole, which is what he referred to as God, he referred to it as she. And it was always in the feminine, you know. So, you know, I'll share that with you on that light. Okay, I guess we better call it quits here. I'm going to fall asleep on you.